Hi there.
So, thanks for showing up at this early hour of the morning. I've been on West Coast time, so this is really early. I am Leisha Sterling. I'm the executive director of Geeks Without Bounds, and I'm also on the board of directors of an organization called Frontline Wellness. I hope you'll come to our workshop at noon, just like a little shameless pitch. Where they've changed the name of the workshop we're doing at noon in the brochure. The real name of the workshop is Assholes and Infiltrators. So hopefully you'll come and find out all about assholes and infiltrators. And that workshop actually came out of some of the same work that I'm going to be talking to you about here at Standing Rock. So this talk is Tech Warrior Camp at Standing Rock, Lessons for Keeping the Lights On and the Live Feeds Streaming. So I've given a bunch of talks about Standing Rock, about what we did, about the security issues that we had there, and I wanted to make this talk a little bit different. So although the first part of the presentation slides are actually pretty much the same slides as from my other talk, it's mostly so you guys can see the pretty pictures before I move into like the real meat. So we're going to be clicking through a bunch of slides pretty fast. But let's start off with something. How many of you guys have heard of Standing Rock and what happened at Standing Rock? Okay, almost everybody. How many of you have heard of the Uni Stoughton camp? Not a single one of you. So I think that they are now in their eighth year. How many of you are aware of the Bayou Bridge camps? A few. How about the Sabal pipeline camps? Pretty much the same people. Water protectors over here. Line 3. Have you heard of Line 3? Oh, we're down to one water protector in the room that knows of Line 3. And how about the DAPL camps in Iowa? There's a few people. Okay. So why do you think that you've heard of some of these and you haven't heard of others? I think that there is a combination of factors that one of the key factors is social media use. So some of these have been using a lot of social media, Bayou Bridge, Line 3, but a lot of them haven't used social media hardly at all. The Uni Stoughton camp does have a social media presence, but it's not a big presence, and it's mostly just the leaders and organizers of the camp that put things out. By the way, I'd like to apologize to the nation if I am pronouncing Uni Stoughton wrong. So you're not seeing a lot of live feeds or pictures from the general public from that camp. And you're not really seeing a whole lot on social media from some of these other camps as well. And a big reason why everybody knows about Standing Rock is because first, there was a lot of grassroots social media action to get the information in front of people. And then because it became viral on social media, the ordinary media couldn't completely ignore it. But even if the ordinary media hadn't picked up on it, a lot of people would still know about Standing Rock because of how much effort was put into the social media presence. And that's an important reason for why I ended up going to Standing Rock. So it seems like everybody in this room knows what this is about, but in case there's anybody on the internet who happens to be watching this who doesn't know what it's about, there was a pipeline, there is a pipeline, but back at this point, there was a pipeline planned called the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it was planned to go across the Missouri River, and also through some sacred lands that belong to, by treaty, the rights to them belong to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And not just the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, actually. The treaty gives the rights to the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota people in general. And permission was not received from the signatories of that treaty to put this pipeline through. And so there were direct actions on the ground, including a massive camp that at one point was the third largest city in all of North Dakota, which I think is pretty impressive for a place that before and after is literally just an open field. To give you some idea of how remote this is the satellite image of where Ocheticheacuing is. Ocheticheacuing, by the way, is Lakota for the Seven Fires or the Seven Council Fires. It is the name of the Lakota Nation in Lakota. This place was also very much a war zone. My first hint that this was a war zone was when I arrived coming down the highway towards the camp. About 30 miles outside the camp, there's this this roadblock. And the roadblock really reminded me a lot of roadblocks in the West Bank. And that is not hyperbolic at all. There were National Guard with rifles, and they would stop you. And if you were white, they would ask you, have you been down this road recently? And if you said no, they would say, well, we just want to let you know that there's some camps down here, and there are some people who might be walking along the side of the road, so please drive carefully. Thank you very much. And they'd let you through. And if you said yes, they'd say okay. They'd let you on through. Now, if you weren't white, you had a very good chance of not being allowed through at all. And there was a place there where they would make you turn and go the long way around. They weren't actually stopping you from going to the camp. They were just making you take an hour and a half to take a drive that should have taken 30 minutes. That's it. So these are some pretty pictures, in case you haven't seen what the camps looked like. It was really dramatic and amazing to come upon this place and see all those teepees and all those tents. But as you can see, there's no mains electricity, no running water, no sewer, nothing like that. There are some awesome revolutionaries holding up Worried Monkey. So when we got there, or before we got there, we knew that one of the keys to Standing Rock already was the fact that they were getting the social media word out there. And they didn't have any internet at the camps. You had to travel 10 miles to get to the casino to use the internet. And the cell phone connection was bad, if not completely non-existent in the area, because this is really the middle of nowhere. But the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe does have their own ISP and a mobile phone company called Standing Rock Telecom. And so what we did was we connected directly to Standing Rock Telecom using Ubiquiti power beams and beaming the network from where the internet backbone basically comes into the tribal lands at Standing Rock Telecom to a hill outside of camp, because we didn't have direct line of sight from one place to the other. So we went to a hill outside of camp and then beamed it down into camp. And from there, we had a small mesh network, which sometimes was bigger than others. We'll get to that in a minute. You can see my other talks to find out how the plan of exactly how we would lay out the network changed and why. But I just want to say that if you're going to put together a network for a community that is not your own, take the time to listen to the people that are there. We thought that because the Sacred Fire was a place where everybody gathered, that there should be a network connection there. Had we not bothered to listen, we probably would have put one there, and that would have made people very upset. The people that mattered, that is. It would have made other people very happy because we were being told by white people constantly right up to the very end, why don't you have a network node at the Sacred Fire? And the answer was, because the Lakota don't want one there. That's the Sacred Fire. So please, when you go into another community, make sure to listen before you act. All right, so we had to ship in a lot of equipment, and we were concerned about things getting messed with. So we had stuff drop shipped to UPS. I'll tell you that I don't think that that did us much good, because the rate of hardware failure was way above coincidental. We had to do a lot of driving to find the place where we would be able to get the internet down into camp, but that means that I got to see lots of beautiful North Dakota / Lakota Territory views. So you see in that one picture down there, there is an old, I'm guessing it's like from the 1930s, windmill, defunct windmill. And that became our ad hoc tower on a hill, which is actually a sacred place. We were required, well, we were asked, but we required of ourselves because we were asked that every time we went up there that we would bring tobacco and lay it at these stones at this sacred site, because it was kind of a big deal that we were putting up network equipment there. But this, you'll see this same tower in a little bit, and it becomes unrecognizable almost. So you can see the nano beams where we were catching the internet in camp. And, you know, here's some of the process of us getting it all put together. Like I said, there were a lot of hardware failures. We had to swap out a battery, like, you know, one of those big batteries. We had to swap out a router. We had to swap out one of the power beams. There were just a lot of things that failed straight out of the box that just should not have been. Okay, so here's some more pictures of us getting that ready. But I'd like to remind you that this was a war zone. And there went my phone. So this was a war zone. I want to make that really, really clear. Because when you're thinking about putting together your networks, even if you're putting together a network in your hometown, you need to think about what's going to happen in disaster situations or, you know, when the government does stupid things. When I say that this was a war zone, I say it because I'm comparing this to the low-intensity warfare tactics that are used by the United States government and trained by the U.S. military to other militaries around the world to use against insurgent organizations. They were using infiltrators. In a few minutes, you're going to see some pictures of where they cut wires. They were destroying our solar systems on a regular basis. They walked away with entire solar panels. They walked away with deep cycle batteries. They walked away with a nano beam one time. They had people, if you've heard of Red Fawn, if you haven't heard of Red Fawn, look her up. She was actually framed by a guy who infiltrated the camps, managed to become her boyfriend, and then planted his own gun on her so that she would get arrested. And she's now going to jail for 57 months, even though she was framed, because the courts wouldn't let her show the evidence of being framed. And of course, there was the super militarized police that I'm sure all of you guys have already been complaining vociferously about how the U.S. police or the police in the U.S. have gotten militarized. So we had a lot of troubles getting our network started. And in the process of that, over the course of a month of work, some of which was diplomatic work and some of which was swapping out gear that should have worked when it showed up but didn't, we finally got the network running. And hold on. Stop. Sorry. We finally got the network running. And to this day, I'm disappointed because I tweeted Boing Boing that the very first site that we connected to was Boing Boing. And they didn't retweet us or anything. My feelings are hurt. All right, so I was telling you about infiltrators. So they knew that we had internet a couple days later, and they started immediately trying to sabotage us. They didn't know we had wireless internet, so they went to the closest fiber box and tried to mess with the fiber, which when we discovered that, we thought that was hilarious, but I also feel bad for whoever had fiber to their homes that got messed with. And then the winter set in. We lived in tents with wood heaters, and our solar systems kept the lights on. We used LED Christmas lights. So if you ever find yourself in a situation where you need to keep the lights on and don't have a whole lot of power, remember LED Christmas lights. They are the bomb. Here's an example of another solar system. So we had trailers like this. We had, I want to say, four trailers like this. This one belonged to the Red Lightning crew, who were also the people who owned that dome in the back. For anybody who did come to camp, the dome was basically the community meeting place other than the sacred fire. It was a lot warmer than the sacred fire because unless you were right next to the sacred fire, it was pretty cold. And we had heaters inside the dome. There were morning meetings every 9 a.m. in the dome. There were dances, Thanksgiving dinner at the dome. This was a major important place. So Red Lightning brought this solar system, and the Tech Warrior team, although we didn't install this system and several of the other systems like it, we were still responsible for maintaining them. And when they got damaged, we would get called up on the radio, and one of the guys or gals that worked with me would head down and fix things. As I was saying before, the infiltrators were quite active. There was a nano beam up there. Somebody knew that the nano beam used power over Ethernet, so they didn't just cut the thing down. They first sabotaged the solar trailer that you just saw in the previous picture so that it wouldn't have power going to it, and then they cut the thing down. And we're assuming that the reason that they walked off with the whole nanobeam was because they were hoping to get our passwords into our network. And so as soon as we found out that this happened, we had to change all of the passwords for the whole network. This is that same tower that you saw at the beginning. And this tower had some problems because we regularly got 60 mile an hour winds, sometimes even higher. And when you're rigging things up with, you know, chewing gum and duct tape, the winds will have some effect. But an amazing woman by the name of Jill Ada Burrows went up in a snowstorm at like 20 below zero, which is when this photograph was taken. And I have no idea what magic she did. But after we'd been going up there every 2 or 3 days to fix it, after she did whatever magic she did to that tower, the wind didn't knock anything over for over a month. So that's that's the overarching story of what happened at Standing Rock. Like I said, there are other talks that go into a lot more detail about what happened at Standing Rock. What I really want to talk to you about is the lessons from all of this. So, first off, the revolution is not going to be televised unless it is live streamed first. You need to have internet if you're going to get the word out about whatever the heck it is that you're doing. You need to take pictures, you need to take video, you need to post memes, you need to get the word out by all means necessary. Have people write essays, Medium, whatever. Get the word out, encourage people to use their social media to share whatever it is that you're working on with your friends. I'm focusing a lot on why we need the internet in situations of activism, but the same thing is true in situations of, say, a refugee crisis or even an emergency, right? A disaster. Because if a disaster happens in the United States, we're probably going to know about it because of the news. But if the disaster is going on in, you know, an island nation that the U.S. news doesn't care about, how are we going to find out about it? The fact of the matter is, we're only going to find out about it if people are able to get the word out through social media. And if they're going to get actual real aid, they need people outside of their, you know, small environment to know what's going on. That's all I'll say about that and the international aid system, except to say that if the general public in high resource countries like the United States and like Europe don't know about some disaster that's happening in some smaller, poorer country, those people just really are not going to get the help that they need. But if we do know and we're talking about it and we're worried about it, it puts the pressure on the larger organizations to get the things taken care of, but it also gives us the opportunity to do grassroots work to help out. And also in the case of a refugee crisis, like what's happening to the Rohingya Muslims. So who knows about the Rohingya and the fact that they're in Bangladesh right now. So there's a fair amount of people that know. And this is a case where the news is talking about it. But from what I've been able to gather from conversations with people, people know sort of these like broad overarching things about what's going on, but don't necessarily know the specifics, and not that many people know how they can help. And being able to use the internet actually helps those people connect with people that are close to them that actually can help, geographically close, I mean. So, lessons learned from all of this. People issues are harder to hack than tech. At Standing Rock, one of the reasons that it took us so long to connect to the internet was because I felt that it was really important for us to connect to the tribe's own internet and not connect to an outside network provider, partly because it was a matter of supporting the tribe. We were here for the tribe's sovereignty. And around this issue, yes, this was an environmental issue, but this was also very much a tribal rights issue because the pipeline was being put through despite the fact that there is a treaty saying that you can't do that without their permission. So I wanted to stand on that ethic that we had to support the tribal sovereignty. We also had troubles with just getting permission to be in the place where the Hop Hill was. Like I said, we did get trained and told what we were supposed to do when we were up on that hill. Took a lot of listening, took a lot of learning and not coming in and being like, oh, we're the techies, we know what to do, we're just gonna fix this for you. You just can't do that and not be, well, an asshole. And if you come to the thing at 12, We're all assholes, but let's try to be less assholes. Anyway, so another big lesson learned is that your first priority for telecoms is electricity. If you're in the middle of nowhere, or if you just had a disaster, you might have the best network gear in the whole wide world. If your electricity isn't working, it's going to do you absolutely no good. A lot of times what we would do is we would set our morning priorities of get the electricity up and running in this place, in this place, in this place, so that tomorrow we can set up some network gear there. So-and-so said that their power has been sabotaged. Go fix their power so that we can have network there. And of course, having power wasn't just about having the network. It was also about having LED Christmas lights so that you could see at nighttime. But if your electric systems work or don't work, nothing else is going to. Another is know your threat model. I did not know my threat model going into Standing Rock. Standing Rock completely changed my life on so many levels. And one of them is that after years and years and years of being sort of theoretically paranoid, now I am deeply and viscerally paranoid about everything. Whereas it was always about those other people over there that need to be concerned about surveillance, suddenly it became extraordinarily personal. And I hate to say this, but for the vast majority of us, we are not going to really comprehend our own threat model until it's brought face to face with us. So if you know somebody else who's already in the midst of whatever threat model you're dealing with, talk to them and listen to them. Pay attention. Don't ignore when somebody says, no, really, I need you to put that phone in the Faraday cage. It may seem a little paranoid to you, or a lot paranoid to you, but they probably have a good reason for it. The other thing, assholes and infiltrators. Like I said, 12 p.m., you totally want to come to my workshop with Joel. It's really important to have appropriate paranoia. So one of the things that happened at Standing Rock is that pretty quickly, once we knew that we had lots of infiltrators, and you can't possibly know who those infiltrators are. Well, some of them you can figure out, but most of them you can't. So then everybody started thinking that everybody was an infiltrator. I was an infiltrator. Johnny Acerone was an infiltrator. He was like the second in charge of the whole camp. The tribal chief was an infiltrator, like everybody. Oh my God, did you notice he did such and such? Do you think he's an infiltrator? And the answer that we came to somewhere in like early December, I think, was no, not an infiltrator, just an asshole. So like learn to recognize, is somebody doing stupid things because, you know, they're human and they're an asshole just like the rest of us? Or is it something more serious, and how are you going to deal with that? Working with volunteers, and I would say this goes actually working with employees as well, if you do have some sort of employee situation, have a clear onboarding process. You may be in the midst of a crisis because you're at a refugee camp or an emergency response situation, but you still need to have a clear onboarding process. Think about that before you ever go out if you have the opportunity. But even if you don't have the opportunity and you just find yourself in the midst of it, take the time, even though you don't think you have the time, make the time to create a proper onboarding process, because it will save you so much time later on. Also, make sure that you have your secure network configuration in greater than two places. I said greater than or equal to, but really greater than two places. We had a situation where our entire network configuration booklet with all of the passwords and IP addresses and everything ended up going on a trip to Tanzania by accident. Yeah, irony. All right, so more networks. what we learned at Standing Rock has allowed us to help a bunch of other people think about and plan and build other networks. Aziz Razul is in the process of building a wireless network for the Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh. And he and I have spent many long hours on the phone discussing the environment, looking at maps, figuring out what the best network gear for him is. There's also a couple of local communities in India, rural communities that have terrible internet and some other issues, let's just say that, with their internet access. And so they're building their own networks. There's one that I didn't add on here that actually predates Standing Rock, and that is we worked on a project that we called CanoeNet, which was putting together networks that aren't directly connected to the internet but have their own internal in their village Wi-Fi connections, and the content that the community wanted from the internet would be brought on a hard drive by canoe. That's why it's called CanoeNet, from the closest town that actually has internet out to the jungle. And they would, you know, had their server where they could actually get things like Wikipedia and stuff like that locally for local education. That is a really good, that's a good network model for some communities who don't necessarily need to have a connection to the outside world all the time, but want to have the ability to have network communication within a specific zone. Myron Dewey has been working for a while now on trying to get a Wi-Fi network connected at the Walker River Paiute Reservation in Nevada. Unfortunately, in 2017, I had, you know, pretty much no resources to go down there myself and help out. And I hope that he's able to get that done. And you should totally do this in your hometown. And they're telling me that we need to stop. That's why the lights are on. I'm guessing. No, it's only 10:33. Okay. So I'll just keep going. So why do you need to do this? Look at me, I'm the president. All right, so why would you want to do this in your hometown? Net neutrality, maybe? I'm a big believer in community-owned and community-operated companies, co-ops, and I hope that you are too. I know it's great to be able to come in and be the grand dictator of all things and just make things happen because meetings are long and boring. But despite the fact that meetings are long and boring, if you can work together as a community, you can create something that's much more resilient and hopefully won't get swallowed up by one of the big companies that is too big to fail. You can also build resilience into your system. Well, resistance as well. Build resistance into your system, please, people. Build resilience into your systems by, well, for one thing, not being too big to fail yourself. So if you're small, you can experiment with things and try things that the big companies aren't necessarily going to try. And if you're a co-op, you're able to spread the risk of success or failure among the community of people who are willing to take this risk together, you know, in small measure, all of us taking the small risk together as we put these things together. Evolutionary improvements come from heterogeneity. And if we're not trying lots of things, we're not going to move things forward and improve just the system in general. But also heterogeneity means that if there is a disaster that takes out all of X kind of system, then there's Y kind of system that might still be standing. An example of this, the US government has decided that we no longer need to rely on hams for emergency response. And about a year ago, they were telling Aries that, oh, we don't really need you anymore because now we've got this contract with AT&T. And AT&T has set up these special, super hardened mobile phone systems. And all the emergency responders are going to have access to these super awesome hardened mobile phone systems. And so we don't need your radio relays anymore. So Washington State, well, the Pacific Northwest in general, but I have been living in Washington State, so I know about what happened in Washington State, did a practice run. What do you call that? An emergency
exercise.
Thank you. Words. It's really bad that I'm a speaker and I can't think of words. So they did an emergency exercise on what would happen if the Cascadia fault were to go, you know, 9 point whatever earthquake. And there were all sorts of horrific things that they discovered, like we are completely unprepared and cannot possibly be really prepared. But among other things, it became super obvious that that hardened AT&T network was going to do nobody any good. And really, they need Aries. And the governor of Washington State and the head of emergency response for Washington State said, yeah, we definitely need you guys, Aries. Keep doing what you're doing because we need you when it all goes bad. So that's just an example. If we have only one system, only one company, only one way of doing things, then when something breaks, we're all screwed. So what do you need? What do you need? Have I harped enough that you need reliable power? Whether you're building this in your community or whether you're working on helping support a water protector camp or whatever future Occupy style camp might exist or the next Arab Spring or a refugee camp, whatever. Whatever it is that you're building a network for, you're going to need reliable power. And even if you're at home, even if you are in your hometown, do not think that your mains electricity is secure enough. Sure, use your mains electricity, that's great, but have backup so that when there is an earthquake, a hurricane, whatever happens, that you can connect in your backup and have your network up and running even when the big guys aren't able to get it running in your neighborhood because your neighborhood isn't rich enough or important enough or whatever for the big guys to care about, at the same time that you know that you live in your place and it matters to you. You're going to need network equipment. So I meant to put a bunch of links in here to companies for network equipment. Sorry to say, I was finishing up this morning and my Wi-Fi hotspot wouldn't let me connect to my Evernote. So I promise you all that later on when I'm at the hotel and not here on a, you know, Wi-Fi with lots of hackers, I will try again to connect to my Evernote. And when I post these live on the GWAB website, it will have links to a bunch of different companies. Also, by the way, a number of the companies that sell wireless ISP equipment, like Ubiquiti, have online like videos or podcasts, basically courses in how to set up your own ISP. And there's even a website called startyourownisp.com, I think it is. So there's actually a lot of resources out there on how to start your own ISP. And it's worth taking the time to learn how to do it. A lot of them will go on and on and on about how much money you need. And the fact of the matter is, if you're trying to make a neighborhood or a community network, say here in the United States, in a city like New York or something like that, in addition to all of your network gear, you're probably going to need to spend a lot of money on lawyers, unless you can get the lawyers to donate their time in exchange for internet connection or something. I don't know, because there's legal issues. But if you happen to be at a resistance camp, or if you happen to be on sovereign Native American territory, you can possibly give the big middle finger to whomever needs middle fingers. So you're going to need a connection to the internet. As you heard before, we had a local trusted ISP at Standing Rock. And in some cases, you will have a local trusted ISP that you can connect to. That's super easy. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't take much effort if you do have a local ISP that you can go and talk to the managers and work all that stuff out. But there are tier two network providers that will give you basically a much fatter connection, which will cost you less in the long run. Your actual bandwidth, once you spread it across all of the people within your network, really becomes almost not free, but you know it approaches zero the more people you have involved in your network when you're not just connected to a local ISP, but really become your own ISP. You're going to need to have people to keep it running, whether it's volunteers on site for something like Standing Rock, or whether it's employees who are going to keep it running. There are people who run rural wireless ISPs where it's literally one guy keeping the whole rural ISP running here in the United States. And those guys say that basically they never have vacations. They spend a lot of time waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's kind of like having an infant for the rest of your life. So you don't want to do that. You don't want to be the one guy trying to do this. Make sure that you have a few other people. And this is one of the reasons to have a co-op, because you can find the way to balance out, you know, trade versus cash in order to make sure that you've got the people who are, you know, not just being abused to be used at 3 o'clock in the morning, but are actually getting something out of being part of that. And security. Whew. There is an entire talk. I gave a talk at Linux Fest Northwest, and I gave another talk at Seagull, I think, specifically about security issues that we faced at Standing Rock. And if you're really interested in what we had to deal with there, purely on the security side, you can look at those. But I just want to say, there is nothing that you can do that's going to make your network 100% secure. I don't think that I have to say that to the people that are in this room, but maybe the people who are watching it on YouTube in the future or something, I don't know. There's nothing you can do to make it 100% secure. So you want to make sure that the people who are using your network understand about encryption and use encryption, encrypt all the things. But you also want to make sure that your network is as secure as possible. You use tools. Splunk used to be a sponsor of Geeks Without Bounds, but they're not a sponsor of us anymore, so I don't feel like I have to, you know, apologize or whatever. But Splunk is a really good tool for keeping track of what's happening on your logs. Security Onion. Security Onion, I hear somebody say. It's funny, I can't see you guys at all. oh, there you are. Yeah, using tools that will help you to actually parse your logs and know what's happening, who's trying to connect through your network or, you know, knock on your door, those are very important. But also physical security. As you saw at Standing Rock, we had a lot of physical security issues. I would say that one of the best tools is a hunting camera. So a Wi-Fi camera, if your Wi-Fi goes down, whoops, you don't have your evidence. But with a hunting camera placed, it, you know, strategically pointed at your network gear, If something does happen, you can go find out what's going on. And if you check that regularly, you can check for people coming by and surveilling the site before they actually do something to it as well. So do use cameras, whether you're using internet-connected IP cameras or whether you're using unconnected hunting cameras and going and picking up the SD cards frequently. It's really important because you're probably not going to be able to have a person standing by every single network gear. Also, I want to mention there's more than one way to skin a cat. Aziz Razul was working a few years ago on a really cool project. I think that he was forking a project that came out of Germany, if I'm not mistaken. But Aziz's project was called Delightful, or I should say is called Delightful. I'm pretty sure it still exists. In its, you know, named form, the project itself obviously exists. But so the original project was like these two cans with lights and a light sensor. And instead of having fiber optic cable, they're just, you know, pointed at each other across space, right? And you get fast internet, just like you would over a cable. The problem is you need line of sight, of course, and things like fog and weather can interfere with your network connectivity. But he figured out that actually you could do the same thing and just make it a light pole. And so this project that he's been working on in Pakistan is providing light, street lights, and internet at the same time. So this is something to consider. That project, by the way, is open source, and I really encourage people to fork and make more of that happen in the world. So I've only got a few more minutes, so I'm gonna skip over this and get straight to the Wopila. Thank you to the youth of Standing Rock who led the call to protect the Minisosi, the Missouri River, and to the people of the Great Sioux Nation who welcomed us into their land. I'd like to thank all the volunteers, the donors, the supporters, the keyboard warriors, the senders of chocolate. I love you. And all the other water protectors. And I'd also like to thank the people who answered my GoFundMe because Geeks Without Bounds lost our fiscal sponsor at the end of 2018 because the school factory closed down. And we didn't get a new fiscal sponsor until literally this last month. And so I've been employed but unemployed, i.e. I haven't had any salary or anything since January. And so I put out a GoFundMe to come here. And thank you to everybody who made it possible for me to get to New York and be here. Thank you. Do we have time for questions at all, or we're 10 of. Okay, so we're 10 of, so we don't really have any time for questions, but I will be around. I'm going to walk that way so that the next person can get up here. And you can also reach me at leisha@gwob.org if you have any questions. Thanks.